Dr. Emil Pinta has collected recordings by Jan Pierce for over 50 years. His articles about the tenor have appeared in Record Research, New Amberola Graphic, and Victrola and 78 Journal. He's published a discography that covers the Metropolitan Opera's star's recording career over 51 years. Excuse me. Emil is a retired psychiatrist, and this morning he gets into the head of Pierce's dance band alter ego, Pinky Pearl. Emil?
It's a PowerPoint presentation, ARSC Early Dance Band. Great. Okay, wonderful. Thank you. I have a handout of the Early Dance Band recordings that I compiled. And I'll be going over some of those, of course, during the presentation. Those of you who read the abstract know that the title is a little bit of a tease and that Pinky Pearl was one of the stage names that Jan Pierce used on some of his early recordings. And we'll get to those recordings in a few minutes, but first I thought I could just briefly run through some of the highlights of this tenor's career that will help put some of these recordings into some kind of a time perspective. Jan Pierce was born in 1904 and raised on New York's Lower East Side. His parents had immigrated to the United States from Russia in 1902. At age 14, as a violinist, he organized a four-piece combo that played at weddings and other small venues. And when he was 15, he joined his local musicians union as a violinist. Throughout his career, he continued his membership as a violinist, saying that he might need something to fall back on. In the late 20s and early 30s, he was a violinist and part-time vocalist with dance bands in the New York area, often appearing as Jack Pearl or Pinky Pearl, which were shortened versions of his real name. And then in 1931 and 1932, he had an engagement at the with Jack Berger's orchestra, the house band, at the Hotel Astor, which was one of the premium hotels in the New York area. Somehow I had a slide of a Hotel Astor, but must not have come up on this. Anyway, his earliest recordings date from February 20th, 1931, when he was a vocalist with Jack Berger's Hotel Astor Orchestra. And on the right, I have a copy of a label, the Romeo label, that was issued on one of the ARC labels. It was the store label for Crest Dime Store. And on the left is a photo of Pierce from a piece of sheet music at about the same era. While singing at a banquet at the Hotel Astor, singing the song Yours Is My Heart Alone, a serious song, he was heard by Samuel Rotherfeld, Roxy, the movie theater impresario, and Roxy signed him for the opening of Radio City Music Hall, which occurred in December 1932. Of course, this was a huge presentation, huge opening. Anyone who was anyone was there, including such people as Leopold Stokowski, Amelia Earhart, many important figures. And on the program, he is listed as John Pierce. Roxy had suggested that he change his name because there already was an entertainer by the name of Jack Pearl. And he was to sing the last number on the program, a song entitled Journey's End. Well, the program ran way into the wee hours of the morning, and Number of selections had to be cut, including this selection, which was a big disappointment for Pierce. But he did stay on with the Radio City Troupe for 8 years, singing in their Sunday evening programs and also their stage presentations. And in 1934, he introduced the song Bluebird of Happiness at Radio City Music Hall. And he made his first recording of this on a transcription for the World Broadcasting Company using the pseudonym Paul Robinson. The Depression-era song with its cheerful message caught on, and it became a song that became associated with him throughout his career. In 1945, he made a recording for Victor that sold very well, and he often included this song at the end of his performances. And the song Bluebird of Happiness became the title of his 1976 biography. Meanwhile, while he was singing at Radio City Music Hall, he was taking voice lessons from several well-known teachers. And in May 1938, he had his operatic debut with the Columbia Opera Company, a touring company in Baltimore. And then his Met debut was 3 years later in November 1941 as Alfredo in La Traviata. And Pierce remained at the Met for 21 years and appeared in over 200 performances at the Met and over another 100 performances with the Met on tour. During the 1940s and 50s, he was one of the leading tenors at the Met, particularly in the Italian repertoire. Pierce's recording career, I wonder if we could, if there's a way of dimming those lights a little bit. Do you know? Yeah. Because I don't think these slides are showing up as well as I would like them to. Yeah, that's better. Pierce's recording career spans over 51 years from the February 1931 recording that I mentioned to a concert of religious music that was given in Dayton in May 1982 and that was recorded on the Tambor label. 4 days after he gave this concert, Pierce had a stroke that partly paralyzed the right side of his body, and he continued to vocalize, but he never performed again after that time, and several other strokes subsequently incapacitated him, and he died in Manhattan in 1984 at the age of 80. He was a very prolific recording artist, and his recordings include over 500 titles that were issued on numerous singles and LPs and now have been reissued on a number of CDs. And he sings a wide variety of music, including operatic, other classical, religious, popular, show tunes, and even some children's music. I compiled a list of these recordings in a discography that I put together in 1986. And the last update I have it is 1996. And if any of you would like an electronic copy of this, just send me your email, and I have my email on a slide at the end of the presentation, and I'll be happy to forward you an electronic copy of it. It's still somewhat usable. It's in bad need of an update in case you know of anybody interested in a discography project. Also, if you didn't get the handout, send me your email, and I'll send that to you. We can now get to the actual recordings. Pierce made 13 sides as a vocalist. The abstract is incorrect. It's incorrect. It says 12 sides, but he made 13 sides, and they can be grouped together into four different recording sessions, and we'll hear at least one vocal from each of those four recording sessions today. So, the earliest vocal, the earliest matrix number, and these are recorded for the American Record Corporation, and those are the various ARC labels there, was the Falling in Love Again. And then on the flip side is All on Account of Your Kisses. And an oddity is that matrix numbers with the takes five from both of those sides have identical label credits, but a different artist and different arrangements. So, Maestro Martin, if you can play the first track, we can listen to this recording. There's quite a bit of... Now, there's not much hint of a voice there destined for an operatic career, is there? But same with most of the vocals. The next one is a peppier vocal, and actually, I think you get a good chance to hear the good sound of the Jack Berger Orchestra. I don't know if you can see those labels, but they both say vocal chorus by Jack Pearl. Okay, the second track, Martin? If anybody wants to get up and dance, you can feel free. Now, this take five, with the same matrix number, is not Pierce. The matrix number, take number five, is on the left. It has the exact same label credits as the Romeo side on the right, but the side on the left has another vocalist, and I think even though you've only heard a couple by Pierce, you can tell that this vocalist is a different person. And if you have the record in hand, it's easy enough to tell take number five because, well, you can't see a two over there, but take number five is pretty clearly visible in the runout area. Okay, track number three, Martin. Not much question there. It's a different vocalist, but the exact same label credits. His next recording session was about a year later in February 1932, and these were issued on the Crown label. Now, Crown was a Depression-era label that existed from 1930 to 1933. They had their own recording studios in New York, but the Crown records were pressed by RCA Victor. And these are labeled Lou Gold and his orchestra now. There was an orchestra leader by the name of Lou Gold, but his name was also frequently used as pseudonyms on records, and it's not clear whether this is actually Lou Gold or another, or whether Jack Berger and his orchestra. Snuggled on Your Shoulder, and then Dancing on the Ceiling. Here's a label and the sleeve of Crown with their tagline at the bottom, slogan, two hits for two bits. Snuggled on Your Shoulder. Here they have Pinky. Here he spells Pinky with an I-E. And then the Lou Gold Dancing on the Ceiling version has no vocal credits on the label. And it's called a long playing record, and this was Crown's venture into fine groove recordings. And this particular record plays for 4 minutes and 20 seconds. And we'll have just, there's actually two vocalists on the record. The first vocalist is Jan Pierce. The second vocalist is probably Marty Golan. We're not gonna play that one, but we'll just play a part of the Dancing on the Ceiling selection with Pierce. So this is track number 4, Martin. Then in August 1932, there were three selections with, I believe, is the Jack Berger's Hotel Orchestra. And on the first two selections, the orchestra is listed as Alice Blue Gown Orchestra, but I feel pretty confident that it's really Jack Berger's orchestra, and you can see that the matrix numbers on the left pretty well match up. And the third item, Something in the Night, does have Jack Berger's orchestra identified, and that one was reissued, by the way, on a Pearl CD, no connection with Pinky Pearl, that's English Pearl CD company. Here's copies of the labels of, I guess I'll have to change my plans, Crown label at the left, identifying Jack Pearl, and then the more uncommon Gem label on the right, which was a subsidiary of Crown. So we can play that one, Martin, track number 5.
I guess I have to change my plan. I should have realized there'd be another man. I overlooked that point completely until the big affair began. Before I knew where I was at, I found myself upon the shelf, and that was that. I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air. My feet are back upon the ground. I've lost the one girl I found.
Pretty nice vocal. The flip side, Nightfall. And then the Something in the Night, giving credit to Jack Berger and his Hotel Astor Orchestra. And this one, by the way, was on YouTube the last time I looked. Then in November 1932, he made six sides with either a studio band of the American Record Corporation or Jack Berger's Hotel Orchestra. Now, Brian Rust, in his 1975 American Dance Band discography, listed this one as a studio band of the American Record Corporation. But then in the 1989 Rust and Alan Debus book, Entertainment Discography, they list this one as Jack Berger's Orchestra. But there are some hot selections on some of these sides that I think do not sound to me like the Jack Berger Orchestra. So At Last Has Come to This is the earliest of those matrixes, and Here's the same record on three different labels. No vocal credits are given on this one. And then In the Dim, Dim Dawning, and I think this one, I would say, has a Jimmy Dorsey sounding clarinet, if not actually Jimmy Dorsey himself. And on the Banner label, you cannot see it too clearly, but it does give the vocalist, as Pinky Pearl, the Mellotone label, the vocal is anonymous vocal chorus. So we'll play this one, and then you can hear some of the accompaniment, clarinet accompaniment, and maybe even Tommy Dorsey on the trombone. Okay, track number 6.
In the dim, dim dawning, as I start yawning, kiss my sweetie good night, sweet dreams, good night. Oh, the moon is sinking, the stars are blinking, but why do I care for their light? Her eyes are quite as bright. 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, I should have said goodbye at 10. 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, I start saying goodbye again. In the dim, dim dawning, as I start yawning, kiss my sweetie good night, sweet dreams, good night. Say
that side definitely sounds different than the Jack Berger side. So the rest of the selections from the November 22nd, 32 recording session are When the Wandering Boy Comes Home, Remember Me, and A Boy and a Girl Were Dancing. Here's a couple labels from that, including the Canadian Royal label on the right. This one has another pseudonym, Dan Roberts, and his hometowners, with the vocalist being anonymous. And a girl and a boy and a girl were dancing on Perfect label, also anonymous vocalist. And another kind of oddity is What a Perfect Combination, with Cliff Martin and his orchestra. It's the opposite side of the Dim, Dim Dawning. And Matrix 12633 has Pierce. It's on the Mellotone label. You can see the Matrix number under the not licensed to broadcast statement. But the record at the right even gives the vocalist as Dick Robertson, and the Matrix is 12634. So, I mean, if you ever thought that Matrix numbers weren't all that important, and discographers pay quite a bit of attention to Matrix numbers and to takes, you can see that you can think you're getting a Pierce when you're not. My sources for the discography were Russ Books. Mainly I used the Russ Books for recording dates and for some additional ARC catalog numbers. But I've got a couple records on here that are not included in Rust, and also I was able to fill in several Matrix numbers that were missing with Rux. So just a little bit about some correspondence that I have with Pierce and some of my interest in Pierce. This is the first recording that I got by Jan Pierce, bought in a Cleveland record store, probably Record Rendezvous, back in 1958. And somehow I got hooked with his voice, and I began to collect his recordings. And over the years, I tried particularly to find the ones Pinky Pearl and Jack Pearl. And they weren't that easy to find in those days. We didn't have the internet. I had to send out want lists to people that advertised in the back of Hobbies magazines and other record magazines. And finally, by about the early 70s, early 70s, I had maybe three or four of these Pinky Pearl records. So it occurred to me that maybe Jan Pierce himself didn't have these recordings, because they were hard to locate. And so I wrote a letter to Pierce, and I told him the recordings that I had and offered to make him a tape. I sent it to the only address I had, which was his agent. And I didn't really expect to hear anything back, so I was very surprised when I got back this letter here, back dated September 21st, 1972, that said in the second paragraph, "Believe it or not, I do not have any of the records you're referring to in your letter." And of course, he asked me if I'd be good enough to tape them, even offered to pay me to tape them, which of course I didn't do. But I sent him then, and then over the years, whenever I got one or two more of the Pinky Pearl recordings, I would send him one, and I'd usually get a very nice letter thanking me for it. Then in 1975, those of you who subscribe, used to subscribe to Record Research, remember those auction lists at the back? You had to use a magnifying glass to see them. Back in 1975 then, Len Kunstad, who ran the auctions and was the editor, publisher, and one of the major contributors of Record Research for over 40 years before his death in the mid-90s, had a little notation here with this Grey Gull record, ? Jan Pierce. Well, Len was, you know, an extraordinary collector, very knowledgeable, so I thought this was an opinion that really needed to be taken with high regard. So I managed to get this record, and I got it, put it on tape, and I must have played the thing 50 times within the first week or two. Half the time I was convinced that it was Pierce, the other half I was just as convinced that it wasn't Pierce. So I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll make a tape of this. I'll send it to Pierce himself and get his opinion. And sure enough, a couple weeks later, I got a letter back from Pierce, but it wasn't what I expected. He says in the second paragraph, "As far as my tracing the voice on the record, I would have to spend a little bit more time to relate to some of the voice." No, he couldn't tell. I didn't feel so bad. And he apparently listened to it, couldn't tell himself whether it was him. And then, look, when I come to a conclusion, I will exchange with you and compare notes. I mean, what? How cool is that? How flattering. He was going to put my opinion on par with his own as to whether or not it was him singing. And then he also asked me if I would send him a cassette. He says, Royal 1940. What he means there are the 15 or so records he made on the Eli Oberstein Royal label in 1939-1940. So I sent him a cassette. And a couple weeks later, I got this response from him, thanking me for the cassette, telling me he just got back from Israel, was on his way to Australia. But unfortunately, he never did get back to me to compare notes about whether Grey Gull 1505 was him or not. But you'll get a chance to see what you think about it. And this is the record in question. It's recorded somewhere between 1927 and 1928. Now, Grey Gull at this time had studios in New York City on 42nd Street, so it's entirely possible that Pierce could have dropped in there, made a few extra dollars. The side that I have recorded is There Never Was a Pal Like My Daddy's Gal, and I think it sounds like Pierce, particularly in the lower register with some of the phrasing. But of course, it's a different recording technique that was used by Grey Gull. Plus, it was an earlier, a little earlier recording, and he may have been trying to sound like some of the early pioneer recording artists. So, Martin, if you would play number 7, please.
Her hair is faded gray. She
So what do you think, just for the heck of it, show of hands, how many here think that that is Pierce? How many here think it's not Pierce? Oh, wow, okay. The not Pierces went out. So I just thought I'd play something of the voice that we generally associate with Pierce. And in 1938 and 39, he made several Lucky Strike transcriptions that were pressed by Victor. And these were apparently played during commercial times for programs sponsored by Lucky Strike, such as Your Hit Parade. This one even came with a nice poster, Jan Pierce singing One Alone from Romberg's Desert Song, 1938. Number eight, and this one has a commercial at the end of it that we can hear too. Number eight. Let that play on. Yet there's a commercial here.
Thank you, Jan Pierce. Ladies and gentlemen, after listening to Jan Pierce's clear, rich tenor, you will understand why Lucky Strike was interested when we first heard that Jan Pierce is a Lucky Strike smoker. Promptly, we made an investigation of the facts, checking his friends, his associates, the Radio City Music Hall, and others in a position to know. Finally, we went to him personally and said, Mr. Pierce, we've discovered that you smoked Lucky's for years. We think this will be of interest to all smokers. Will you tell us your reasons for preferring Lucky's?
And Basil, shall I tell our friends what my answer was?
Please do, Jan.
Well, I simply pointed to my throat and said, right here's where I make my living. And Lucky's have never bothered my throat, no matter how much I sing. That's why I've smoked Lucky's for 11 years now.
I hope there aren't any young people in the audience that are going to be persuaded to take up smoking as a result. And I'll just maybe play one more selection because of time, but this is World War II. We actually do have a connection with World War II here. And the New York World's Fair was held in Flushing Meadows, New York, in 1939 and 1940, and there were actually two fair seasons. The first fair season was from April to October 1939 and had the theme Dawn of a New Day. But by the time the second fair season opened in April 1940, Europe was at war. Germany had invaded Czechoslovakia and Poland. The Soviet Union had pulled its exhibit after being expelled from the League of Nations for the invasion of Finland. And a new theme song was made for 1940 for Peace and Freedom. Now, Pierce, an Orthodox Jew, had to be acutely aware of the specter of anti-Semitism hanging over Europe, and he recorded a version of For Peace and Freedom on an RCA transcript in April 1940. These are the words, and we can pick this one up. It's in the second part of the first stanza there. Number nine, Martin. Words that hold true today. Well, I think we're running out of time, right? But I was going to play a little bit of Fiddler on the Roof, but I neglected to mention this part of Jan Pierce's career. And at the age of 67, 1971, he took over the role of a fiddler in the original run that began with Zero Mostel. He was the second to the last fiddler. And here's a program from the Broadway Theater. And if you can see there, you can get a orchestra seat, row D, for $9.90. Now it won't even pay for your taxi from a Midtown hotel. Okay.